Appreciate it. Always good to chat.
All right, so here we are. We are now to the threshold of the Olympics. There'll be one American attending. That's Dr. Jill Biden. But that's it.
That's it. There's nobody else going. $8 billion right down the drain.
They get, what, 70 to 75% of the revenue the IOC does from broadcast rights. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah, they make all the money. Tokyo's Olympic Committee in Tokyo, the country, are the ones who are stuck holding the bag. It's an unpleasant time. And the fact that it rolls right into Beijing the next year is just, I mean, a perfect storm. It's a really awful situation for them.
What are the odds Beijing has no fans?
At this rate, I don't know. And you know, the bigger problem they're going to have is, you know, whether they get control of, you know, COVID or not, you're still going to have the human rights issues. It's going to be, I mean, I can only imagine the kind of propaganda we're going to see from the Chinese Nationalist Party while the Olympics are going on, and around the world, people are pointing out the human rights just egregiousness that's happening there. It's going to be something that we've never seen before. I mean, the activism is going to be incredible. I'm very curious to see how this is going to play out. It's going to be for sponsors, I can't even imagine how they're going to tightrope walk their way through the Beijing Olympic Games.
Which I'll bring this part up. From a propaganda point of view, Tokyo will have no fans. Beijing, I'm telling Tony, they'll find people. They'll have
every venue
filled up to show the world that they've got everything under control.
Oh, 100%. You know, there's that old story of when the WCW wrestlers went to North Korea and there was 120,000 people in attendance and nobody knew what they were watching. Yeah, nobody paid for those tickets. That's the same thing that's going to happen here. We got to make sure this looks good. There will definitely be people in the seats. Will they be rowdy people? That remains to be seen.
Brisbane's going to get the Olympics in 2032. Essentially, they didn't bid against anybody. Beijing, essentially, they only bid against Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Is there any concern about the fact that there's no the bidding process is to the point where nobody's bidding?
Yeah, I mean, all these businesses go through evolutions, and the pendulum swings both directions. And so this isn't the first time that this has happened. This happened in the mid-70s when they were bidding on the 80s Olympics.
Yes.
And the Olympics were in the exact same situation. And then Peter Ueberroth, and I know you guys were just talking about the home run derby in baseball, but Ueberroth showed up and changed the way the Olympics made money, right? He found a way to make it a profitable games. And Los Angeles introduced sponsorship and a lot of capitalism into the games, and it kind of changed the Olympic Games for the next 20 years. And we've gone a little bit too far in that direction for the IOC. They're definitely wetting their beaks a little bit more than they probably should. And I think we will look back on the era of, you know, the Beijing Games twice in a 15-year period and the Qatar World Cup and, you know, just these nonsensical awards. And we'll laugh at them in 20 to 30 years as it morphs and evolves. There's too much money involved for it to continue this direction. It'll eventually correct. But, yeah, right now you're in a position where if you're a municipality or a country, why would you want to bid on them? It's, especially with what you just saw happen to Tokyo. And, look, Tokyo is the worst possible scenario. But Brazil didn't exactly make out positive either when they hosted in Rio. So, you have to assume that, like everything else, there's going to be some form of correction. Who knows who the next Peter Ueberroth is going to be?
Well, people forget that in 1976, the Winter Olympics were going to be in Denver. And the voters of Denver said, finally, after they'd won it, said no. And that's why Innsbruck ended up. You know, that's where the Olympic movement was.
It happened again with Boston. Boston was the finalist, and they said no. The voters came out, so we don't want it.
Yep, we don't want it. All right, I want to bring up something that you brought up at the end of our conversation the last time, just to let you know I was listening. You said that often you reference European soccer, and I know you said that you wanted to tell the audience that. But I want to reference European soccer in this realm. It's been around much longer than the sports leagues we have in this country. you referenced the Premier League and you referenced Italian soccer. What lessons, okay, history's the greatest teacher. What lessons should pro leagues in this country learn from Italian soccer and from Premier League soccer on the pros and cons?
There's a great book on the Premier League, how it was created and where they've been so successful. Because if you look at a lot of people who don't follow soccer, and I don't blame them, a lot of people don't follow soccer, don't realize the Premier League didn't show up until the mid-90s. Before that, you know, it wasn't about the winning in Europe was important, but the trophies were different. The Premier League trophy wasn't the one that everybody was trying to win. The Premier League showed up at that point. They created a Super League, so to speak, which are the things that are being talked about in college football. So when we talk about, you know, what we're going to learn from history in Europe, you can really tie it all to what's happened there. So the book is called The Club, but if you look at what had happened out there, you had leagues that were relatively close that played together in a postseason, and that postseason was, you know, the UEFA Champions League, which prior to the UEFA Champions League, they had other trophies that they rewarded. And you've seen what happens when you had super clubs kind of take over their own conferences, and then those conferences are almost relegated to be secondary to the national interest. And so you can see there where we're headed with college sports, right? Right now, we look at the Premier League as being this super powerful league, and the Bundesliga as being a powerful league, and La Liga, which is, you know, the Spanish league, which is generally top heavy. There's only two or three teams that really compete on the international level, and Serie A is the same thing, where there's just, you know, rampant corruption, and there's a couple of teams that can compete. That's a roadmap for what could possibly happen in the United States when it comes to college football, because that's what we've seen. You know, as one league got stronger, more players want to go play there. And, you know, a lot of players just get bought and sold out of the smaller leagues to go play in the bigger leagues. And so you could say that the SEC and the Big Ten are, you know, ultra dominant. The ACC, the Pac-12, and those others are just hoping to have one or two or three teams participate. And all the money then rolls into the CFP like it does into UEFA in Europe. You also see the labor rights initiatives that have been happening over there. And you talk about, you know, how, you know, a league can compete against another league without controls, and it can cause economic chaos, right? People get, you know, a little bit blown away by how much money people make in contracts in North America, but when you compare them to what they're paying for Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi, it's peanuts, right? These guys are making more money than anybody. And, you know, we were talking about it this last weekend over at the UFC fight as well, when you have labor unions that have been introduced in some of the professional leagues there, and how that changes how people are being made. So history repeats itself regularly. You and I know a lot about it because we study it, but a lot of these leagues don't. And so, you know, though it does seem like it's a little maybe off the cuff to reference, you know, Premier League soccer when we're talking about SEC football, the parallels are incredible, right, into what happened there. And if we're not careful, that's what's going to happen. You're going to be in a situation where teams that were once competitive historically aren't. You know, if you go to England and you talk about Nottingham Forest, that is a club that is deep in tradition that hasn't competed in 30 years.
Right.
And they can't compete, right? They got close to making it into the Premier League 2 years ago, but they're nowhere near competing on an international level. And this is a team that won Europe multiple times. And are we going to go to a situation where Penn State, Alabama, you know, Michigan, Ohio State are competitive and Indiana never has a chance? Purdue never has a chance. I mean, Indiana's probably not the best example, but Purdue never has a chance to go to the Rose Bowl. Or, you know, Iowa, or teams that, you know, we would consider to be strong teams that eventually just can't compete on a national level. That's the concerning point about when you see that.
College basketball, the NCAA tournament, 19% of the teams make the tournament. 68 out of 357 from all corners of the Continental 48.
Right.
College football,
34 of those are at bid, are at large. So
right,
it's really
exactly
30, right? It's like 30 to 36 teams that get a shot that wouldn't otherwise.
College football's 3%.
Yeah.
By going to 12, it would get it to 9%. Can going to 12 create at minimum the mirage to then prevent what we just talked about in soccer?
What they did in soccer, for the listeners who don't follow what's happened there, is they said, we need to create automatic bids from leagues, and then we need to stack the leagues based on how competitive they are. So at the end of every season, you get invited to the UEFA Champions League, which is the, you know, European league for clubs that compete against each other. And the Premier League, for example, gets four teams, while the Dutch league gets one, while right. the Greek league kind of gets one. They get to play in a play-in game, right?
Right.
And yep. that sounds fair. Sounds fair-ish, right? Like, okay, USF or UCF, you want to play? Like, you've got to go beat, you know, the other non-Power 5, Boise State, and the winner gets to go play Alabama in whatever bowl's next. The problem with that is now it's become so lopsided that even those clubs are starting to talk about creating a Super League, which we saw a couple of months ago, and, you know, they gave up pretty quickly and ended up giving up the idea, but that won't be the last time we see that because there's just too much money involved. So, yes, the 12 teams is actually creating some hope that you're going to be able to play on that national level. But as NIL takes over, as players can now make money on their likeness, as players now know that, you know, if there's a 12-team playoff, if you go to a team that makes the playoff, it's no longer the way it used to be where you'll have 12 games in Indiana and possibly a bowl game, so you play 13. Well, if I go to Penn State, I've got 12 games, and then I could possibly play three or four more. So that's a lot more exposure. It's more of an ability to sell my brand. It's more national exposure. You know, the town is a lot more tied to the team, so there's going to be a lot more sponsors willing to pay. It's going to create a competitive imbalance, and it's coming, and it's fine, right? That's how it's going to work.
Which, when you talk about competitive imbalance, there are obviously young people that are attracted to, hey, look, if I go to Alabama, my pathway is going to be faster. I'm playing for national championships. Clemson, my pathway might be faster. Can spreading the wealth happen a little bit more because there would be more possibilities to be in the playoff to then, as you say, expand the brand?
Maybe, but if you look at what's happening with the transfer portal, it's become European soccer, right? You do go to, you know, even if you do go to North Carolina State and you're pretty good for 4 years, what do you do in your fifth year? You transfer to Wisconsin, you take the team to the Rose Bowl, and you get picked in the third round of the NFL draft, and then you win a Super Bowl, right?
Right.
And that's what's happened over there. I mean, I keep belaboring the point, and some might roll their eyes and say these have nothing to do with each other, but that's exactly what happens. You know, 2 years ago,
sure.
one of the most exciting teams was Red Bull's team, because it was a bunch of young kids that they had grown themselves, and eventually they get to a point where they're not competitive, and those kids get sold off. And one of them plays in Germany now, another one plays in the Premier League. And as you're creating this NIL rights, there's just going to be more stories about Baker Mayfield. There's going to be more stories about Russell Wilson. There's going to be more stories about Gardner Minshew, right? These players that they play somewhere for 2 or 3 years, and it's almost like a clearinghouse before you get to go play for the big stakes at the big school and then make your way to the NFL. So there's a lot of parallels between what happened there and what's happening here, and the difference being the international body for soccer has a lot more power in Europe than the college football playoff has power here. Like, in the end, if the Big Ten wanted to pull out, or if, you know, the SEC wanted to create their own bowl game with one another, they could theoretically do this, right? They have that much power compared to the other conferences. So who knows? You and I aren't going to solve it, but it's certainly interesting to watch.
No, it's interesting to watch, but it's also fun to talk about it. Tony, yeah. I've got to ask you about the NBA ratings. PR department of the NBA all the credit in the world. They're doing exactly what you and I talked about a month ago they would do. They would compare everything to September, October 2020.
Yep.
So we all know this is the second lowest rating ever for a final.
Ever. 9.3 million people. 9.3 million. That's incredible.
So now I want to bring up this, because let's go big picture now. The NBA is garnering $2.6 billion a year between their contracts with ESPN and TNT. 1.4 ESPN, yep. 1.2 TNT. Like any entity, they want more in their next negotiation. What has 20 and 21 done anything, if at all, to their ambition of getting more money in their next TV contract?
I think they're going to get more. Here's why. And here, it's you know, I was actually met with a number of RSNs yesterday and had this conversation. We are moving towards an era of debundling and direct consumer. And what that means is, right now, if you want to get your Bucks games, you have to sign up for Time Warner Spectrum or whoever's at the there, right? That's how it works out here in Los Angeles. If you want to watch the Dodgers, you have to sign up for Spectrum. If you want, and you're signing up for 10 other channels.
Right.
So there's a big company called Sinclair who has bought a number of the regional sports networks, and they just put a bid in for 16 more that they're going to buy from NBC Universal. And their intent is to create direct-to-consumer channels that you can get a la carte. So, like, if you want to have, you know, the Big Ten Network, you can just pay $5 a month and have it. You don't have to have a cable carrier anymore. We're seeing that that's the power of live, especially with the next generation coming up who has almost no affinity to live television outside of sports. They watch concert and sports, and that's it. They don't watch any television shows. They binge watch them when they come out on whatever streaming service there is. So selling them advertising is near impossible. And so that's why you see these networks and even Apple. You know, the news yesterday came out that Apple looks like they are going to try to bid on the Sunday Ticket, which makes total sense.
Right.
Looking at this as a differentiated way to have live entertainment that you can monetize, because the days of signing a giant contract so you can you know, run your ads during Friends on a Thursday night, which was the number one show drawing 26 million people, are quickly growing to an end. And if you look at the key demographic of 18 to 34, it's over. But what that demographic is doing is betting on sports, right? Yep. We know that's what they're doing. And so I do think that despite the fact that the ratings are not where they need to be, it's an outlier of a year, right? You've got two teams that were, you know, historically not very good, and who haven't been good for a while. But it still makes sense for them to bid on those deals, and it's going to continue to go up because it's a differentiated way for advertisers to reach consumers that are much more difficult to reach now.
Well, as you pointed out, Bally's has its name all over networks now.
Yeah. Right? Because they're going DDC, and they want you to watch the game for $5 a month, and they want you to bet on it, and they get a rip off the vig there, and they know what they're doing. And you know, I was talking to I think we said this last time. I was talking to one of my friends who runs one of the largest casino providers in the world, one of the top three, and he was on a panel and got in some trouble because they asked him about sports betting, and he laughed and he said, "We're still in the first inning of sports betting." And they said, "Why is that?" And he was on a panel with DraftKings and FanDuel, and they were talking about how much money they pull. And he's like, let me make something clear. Our sports betting department makes less than our Keno department does. So that's going to change as we go forward, but we're not there yet.
Wow.
So the thing he said to me, which blew my mind the most, was we were talking about the T-Mobile Arena. And I said, you know, the last normal year you guys had, we were in a casino in Vegas out there last weekend for the UFC fight. And I told this story before. He said, you know, yeah, T-Mobile Arena did pretty well. I said, I read you guys did $60 million in net profit in a year on it. He said, yeah, that's nice. That roulette table does $1 million a month.
Oh.
So they're looking for the rights because they're trying to drive that. They're trying to drive that behavior. Right. That's where the real dollars are. Advertising and gambling.
Hey, get your backside to Madison, all right? Hey, that's the opening.
I really want to get out there. I do.
I'm pushing you. Okay?
I've never been, and I hear it's an incredible experience. I hear it's one of the top experiences in the country, that they love the Badgers there. And that I think I read that they have the highest attendance of sports across all sports of any university in the country.
Oh, because they sell out all the basketball and their hockey draws.
They sell everything out. Like, women's volleyball sold out, from what I read. Yeah, like, they have the highest attendance of anybody.
Women's volleyball sells out. I think the arena is like 10,000. I used to play basketball there. Kohl Center, 17,000, sold out for basketball. Camp Randall is, I think, 90 now?
Yeah.
Maybe it's in the 80s.
Extraordinary numbers.
Yeah. It's phenomenal.
Yeah,
I'm
going to
keep
pushing.
I'd like to keep pushing.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of live events now. I've been to a lot of them. So I did the fight last weekend. I'm trying to get some more. It's time to get back to normal life, the fun stuff.
Yeah, it's time. It's also time to see you. All right.
Yeah.
I'm doing this all for selfish reasons, Tony. Thank you, my friend. What a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time. The great insight, as always.
All right. We'll talk very soon. Be well.